Morning. I now call this meeting of the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee to order. Welcome back, everyone, to our first hearing of 2022. And we'll start with the clerk taking the roll.
Chair Long.
Present.
Vice Chair Akam.
Present.
Minority Leader Swazinski.
Here.
Representative Bierman. Representative Bierman. Representative Bo.
Present.
Representative Christensen.
Present.
Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Greenhagen.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hornstein.
Present.
Representative Igo.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lippert.
Present.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard present.
Representative Meckland.
Present.
Representative Munson. Representative Munson. Representative Stevenson.
Present.
Quorum is present. Well, welcome back, everyone, again. Today, we'll be focusing on the critical topic of climate justice. We know that pollution is concentrated in neighborhoods that, because of past racist housing policies and laws, have seen a concentration of highways and other industrial uses. We also know that these neighborhoods see disproportionate health impacts from asthma and other diseases. And we know that climate will impact these communities more from heat-related stress and from other illnesses. Our committee has tried hard to center racial equity and climate justice in our work. I'm proud that the bill we enacted into law last year included funding for Representative Lee's Northgate Development Bill to provide training in clean energy careers in North Minneapolis, as well as our Solar in Schools bill, which targeted funding for schools based in part on free and reduced lunch percentage, and the ECO Act, which increased our low-income spending requirements. Now, the bill that passed the House also included additional provisions for tribal energy consultation or a community access program for community solar to improve the low-income community solar program, and a utility workforce diversity reporting as well. So I'm hoping that we can use this hearing today to further center the importance of climate justice in our work this session, and to think about ways that we can integrate these important needs and principles into all of our bills that we are working on this session. We're honored to have for our first speaker today, Cecilia Martinez, who is the co-founder of the Center for Earth, Energy, and Democracy here in Minnesota. She's also become quite the nationally known celebrity on environmental justice issues. She was one of Time's 100 most influential people in 2020, and until last month was the senior director for environmental justice and President Biden's Council on Environmental Quality. And the chair of the council, Brendan Mallory, said of Cecilia on her departure that she has been the heart, soul, and mind of the most ambitious environmental justice agenda ever adopted by a president. So appreciate you being with us today, and we'll turn it over to Cecilia.
Thank you so much, Chair Long. First of all, I want to thank both you and Vice Chair Akam and the rest of the committee members for allowing me time to speak with you today. It really is an honor. And we have come quite a long way in the last 5 years, both in terms of climate, but also in terms of climate and equity. And it has been truly an honor and a privilege to be able to serve the president on his agenda, but also because, and as you mentioned, being a co-founder of the Center for Earth, Energy, and Democracy in Minnesota, what I would like to share is that the president's agenda has very strong roots to the Minnesota community. It is because of the work that SEED and many of you have done and work together on to build the ideas of climate justice and climate equity that the president's agenda actually evolved and developed the way it did. And so I think for Minnesotans, they should be very proud that the kinds of historic things that we're seeing at the federal level do have their roots and their foundation in the work that you all and many of Minnesotans have been doing. I would like to share a bit about the president's agenda. As you mentioned, this agenda goes way back to when many of the advocacy organizations, labor organizations, and business and other types of organizations came together to develop a comprehensive climate agenda back as early as 2019. And it was historic at that time that those types of sectors would come together and talk a lot about what could be a national climate agenda. And to our surprise, during the campaign, many of the candidates did develop some of the key tenets of that agenda that was in process by those conversations. And then, of course, President Biden took that agenda and evolved it much, much further, which we see at this time one of the most historic climate and equity agendas in this country, that this country has ever seen. As you mentioned, we know that there are inequalities in our society that have been there for a long time. As government agencies and as the public sector, we know that our role is to address the common good, that is, to make sure that all communities are thriving, vibrant, and that have equal opportunities for success and for economic vitality. And that, in my view, is what is at the core of a climate and equity agenda. As we were working together with the private sector, with labor, with other climate advocacy organizations in the mainstream world, with energy organizations, and we were first initiating and developing that national comprehensive climate agenda that SEED and others were developing, we developed some basic tenets for what it means to achieve climate equity, both at the national and international level. And I wanna name a few of those. They are by no means comprehensive, but I think they address some fundamental components that we need to develop. And I think Minnesota is obviously one of the leaders in developing both legislation but programmatic initiatives to address these. And the first tenet was that no community will be left behind. This is a longstanding environmental justice principle. That as we develop policies, programs, public-private partnerships, and other initiatives, it is critical to integrate an assessment of the distribution of the costs and benefits across communities. That is something that we have not done historically. Which communities, geographically, spatially, as well as individually, will reap the benefits of our investments, and which communities and community members may be exhibiting or experiencing the costs of our initiatives. And so with the no community left behind principle, we suggest that the potential consequences of our actions are assessed and developed in a way that looks at equity across all communities, racial communities, across racial lines, across income lines. No community should suffer the burdens of any particular initiative. The second tenet, which we know full well, is that climate is so strongly intersectional with air quality, and that climate change is a threat multiplier when it comes to air quality. We know that along with fossil fuel emissions, along with the global emission of greenhouse gases, what we also have is the emissions of local pollutants that are very harmful to local communities. So in the president's agenda, what we tried to do was integrate those two things. How do we address local harmful co-pollutants along with greenhouse gas pollutants in a manner that makes climate change, that promotes climate mitigation, but also will be healthy for the communities in which many of these businesses and industries are located? We also address this notion of cumulative impacts. We know that the environmental regulation framework right now does not address the cumulative impact of multiple sources and multiple pollutants. That is a challenge for us. That is a challenge for you, and that is a challenge for the federal government. So what we see in the president's agenda is many agencies moving towards investing in research and ideas that can begin to address the cumulative impacts of pollution across communities. After all, that is the way in which communities directly experience air quality. And because our regulatory regulatory framework is based on an individual emission pollutant or individual facilities, the cumulative impacts of those on a community are not necessarily addressed. This is historic for the federal government to be providing as much investment, both in research and development, as well as other programs to address that. And lastly, a healthy transportation system and goods movement system. We know that transportation is significant now, greenhouse gas pollutant with carbon. As you have witnessed in the president's infrastructure bill, transportation is a very big target for investments across the country. This is also a challenging area, which we all know, and that much of the transportation investments are based on formula funding, and which there's not a lot of discretion that the federal government has to guide how those investments will happen. And that's where it brings us to you all and the state level governments and local governments. Because the more that we can align with the ideas and the principles and the tenets of what the federal government is trying to do, we can begin to actually make a difference in these investment packages. One of the most historic initiatives that the president has outlined is the Justice 40 initiative. I'm sure you all are aware of it. It is an initiative launched in Executive Order 14008, which identifies that 40% of investment benefits in many infrastructure areas across the country, 40% of the investment benefits in climate, in clean energy and energy efficiency, in clean transit, affordable and sustainable housing, training and workforce development, pollution reduction, and critical clean water infrastructure go to disadvantaged communities. That we haven't seen since the 1960s and 1970s, a dedicated federal agenda to address the needs of the most vulnerable communities in this country. And it seeks to both address these existing inequalities and institute federal programmatic processes that will support the equitable distribution of federal investments into the future. It is the first time in recent federal history that such a comprehensive goal has been established. And this means that there is a critical need for states to identify and prioritize disadvantaged communities, especially given the size of the federal investments. The infrastructure package, $1.2 million, offers an early test of Justice 40. But the Brookings Institution has found that most of the grant programs in the law have surprisingly lukewarm equity statutes. This is why we need state legislatures and state programs to begin working on how they can align with Justice 40. We see some examples already, very important examples that are happening. The National Black Caucus of State Legislators, along with the Regenesis Institute, is helping to support state level actions, both at the legislative and executive branch, that align with Justice 40. The president's home state of Delaware has established the first ever state level Justice 40 Oversight Committee to help the state execute and align with the federal programs that are underway. And so I think this all serves to show that there is an incredible opportunity for us to make a difference to the most disadvantaged and vulnerable communities across the state of Minnesota, but also to partner with other states that are doing leading work in this area as well. So thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today. And I sincerely offer a debt of gratitude for all your hard work and dedication at this critical time. I know we're all working nonstop to make things happen for our communities at a time when COVID and other kinds of challenges are happening. So it is with great appreciation. And I thank you for having me here today.
Thank you so much, Ms. Martinez, for outlining the really incredible and path-breaking work that the administration has been doing that you were a big part of. We're going to have one more testifier, Mr. Kolash, and then we'll take questions before we move to the rest of our testimony. So Representative Hornstein will be first on the list at that time. Next, we are hearing from Frank Kolash, who's the Climate Director with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and we'll be talking about environmental justice impacts in Minnesota. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Kolash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to all the committee members for allowing me to present to you today about climate justice in Minnesota. Again, I am Frank Kolash, Climate Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I use he, him pronouns. And before I start, I want to make sure that I extend my gratitude to the Department of Health and the Department of Natural Resources for their assistance with the presentation that I will provide to you today on climate justice in Minnesota. I will begin sharing my screen. And I hope that that is coming through for you.
Yes, it is. You might want to put the display in a presentation mode.
Thank you. Is that correct?
Yes.
Great. Very good. Thank you. So to begin, we know that climate change in Minnesota is happening and is occurring. The Department of Natural Resources is telling us that we're seeing the 10 warmest years have occurred in the last 20 years. So we know that Minnesota is warming. We're also seeing changes and increases in the precipitation that we're seeing in Minnesota that is now more than three times likely now to have mega rain events, which are more than 6 inches of rain, and also more likely to see larger than 3-inch rainfalls now in Minnesota than in the past. And what those will lead to is changes in Minnesota's environment that also relate to the air pollution, to the weather and extreme heat, to water and our floods and our droughts, and then ecosystem threats that are related to how we experience nature. And I'm going to just briefly go over these. I won't spend a large amount of time on this, but I want to make sure that we understand that there are both direct effects, for example, with air pollution, that we expect to see worsening air quality or more air alert days because we are experiencing the influx of pollution coming in from forest fires and wildfires from the West Coast and from Canada that's happening because of the droughts and the impacts from climate change. And that can lead to direct effects of respiratory challenges, but also loss of work days and people being out sick or children not being able to go to school for that. Similar with extreme heat, that people will be experiencing more heat stress and potential illnesses there. And then with flood and droughts, the psychological, the mental stress of that, but also the injury and damages that happen. And then with the ecosystem threats, there are risks to West Nile virus and other insect-borne diseases that are moving into Minnesota, and that make it more difficult for us to live our lives in Minnesota. And we know that we will all be impacted by these changes, but the particular communities in Minnesota will be impacted more specifically. And so when we look at how we're looking at climate justice within the sub-cabinet agencies and trying to put climate justice and climate equity on our agenda, we use a couple of different models. One is within the social determinants of health, which understands that health does not just relate and react to when the person is at their doctor feeling sick or needing immediate attention for an illness or a disease, but that it has a greater context for everything that is experienced by individuals, and that these social determinants of health can amplify or moderate the climate influence health effects, and then particularly in exposures and our sensitivities and our adaptive capacities to the additional stresses that climate change is going to bring to Minnesotans. And examples of these amplifications will be with exposures where people who are living in economically disadvantaged urban neighborhoods that don't have access to air conditioning or have substandard housing may be more sensitive and be more exposed to high heat events if they don't have the ability to seek refuge for cooling down during these high heat events, with sensitivities that we know that American Indians and African American children have a higher incidence and possibility of getting asthma, and that those will be potentially impacted and be more sensitive to worsening air quality or increasing in pollution or pollen levels in Minnesota, leading them to seek medical care. And then adaptive capacity, people who have lesser resources available to them if they suffer a climate-related impact or disease or illness and they don't have access to medical care, then that they will have a lower capacity to respond and react and recover from those illnesses. Another framing that the Pollution Control Agency uses significantly, and we bring that to the sub-cabinet, is the notion of environmental justice that incorporates the fair treatment and meaningful involvement of all people, regardless of race, color, national origin, and income. And the fair treatment really goes to making sure that no community suffers a disproportionate impact of the actions and the decisions. So similar to the concepts that Ms. Martinez was talking about, making sure that we understand and can assess those. And then the meaningful involvement is making sure that we hear all voices, that those people have access to decision makers. And then importantly for the sub-cabinet basis, that we're reaching out and trying to make sure that we are hearing those voices. And we're trying to do that more and more. So looking to how we have implemented and put climate equity as a priority for the sub-cabinet work, in our draft climate action framework, we have the six sections that look at climate activity and climate actions and solutions in Minnesota. And within each of these sections, we address equity and we identify potential strategies and actions that the state can take to make sure that our climate actions also bring benefits to those other contextual factors that affect people's health so that we can maximize the benefits of the climate actions and also meet the responsibilities that are laid forth in the governor's executive order on climate change, that we're building partnerships and understanding with tribal nations, with people traditionally not represented in policy discussions, and with people who will be disproportionately impacted by climate change and its impacts. And we're also working with our advisory council on climate change to ensure we understand how climate change and impacts will affect our communities, how the solutions can address the current disparities, and how we can incorporate this perspective of people traditionally not been part of our conversations. Looking at the specific actions of sub-cabinet agencies, this is an example where we have started. These are early steps of our agencies taking forth actions that can incorporate climate justice and equity into our operations, both as a sub-cabinet, but our day-to-day operations. Looking at the Pollution Control Agency, that we are trying to target grants to reduce pollution in areas that meet our environmental justice criteria, where we're building the analytical tools and conducting analyses on the disproportionate impacts of air pollution in Minnesota, knowing that air pollution is not experienced the same by everyone in Minnesota, and that we are looking at the equity benefits of particular air regulations moving forward, with the Department of Transportation, the Metropolitan Council, looking at transportation alternatives that are less expensive and more accessible for everyone, and particularly disadvantaged communities, and that is less polluting for those communities. The Department of Commerce looking at ways to ensure that weatherization and energy efficiency and solar energy are available to meet communities of color, our tribal nation partners, and lower income communities. Department of Health, Department of Public Safety in Hennepin County, focusing on the climate and health impacts of emergency management responses in Minnesota. The Met Council has produced online flood maps where they can use that to assess the climate vulnerability to flooding and those communities that may be most impacted there. And then the Department of Natural Resources and Department of Agriculture looking for ways to help underrepresented populations in those areas seek career paths for agriculture, forestry, and natural resource conservation. And bringing this back to the task of the Climate Change Subcabinet and the goals of the Next Generation Energy Act, we're not on track to meet our emission reduction targets that are in the Next Generation Energy Act. And it is critical that Minnesota take action to reduce our emissions, to reduce our impact on the changing climate, to do our best to minimize the potential for these climate impacts happening, not just for everyone, but particularly our most disadvantaged communities. And it's also imperative that we build resiliency into our natural resources, our working lands, our community, our public services, and our people and their health, to make sure that we are able to react to the changing climate based on past emissions moving forward. And that we know that equity does not mean that we treat everyone equally. We need to tailor our actions to meet the needs of the communities to make sure we get the maximum benefit moving forward so that all Minnesotans can thrive in the future and be healthy and move forward with that. At that point, that concludes my presentation, and I will entertain any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Colash. So we've heard the federal and state perspectives on climate justice work. We're going to take about 10 minutes for questions, and then we'll go to the rest of our testimony. Representative Hornstein.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate this discussion this morning. And my question is for Ms. Martinez. And Ms. Martinez, thank you so much for your work and your excellent testimony. And I especially appreciate that you mentioned transportation. I'm the chair of the Transportation Committee, and we are really looking and have been looking at incorporating climate and equity principles in our work. I'm wondering if you have any examples. You had mentioned sort of the Justice 40 initiative oversight in Delaware. Are there any examples around the country of states that are looking at the federal infrastructure bill matching money in a way that incorporates climate and equity principles?
Good question. Ms. Martinez.
Are you asking specifically in transportation or across the board?
Yes, Ms. Martinez. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. I honestly don't have that information at hand. I could certainly put you in contact with the DOT folks that are working very hard with states and the intergovernmental folks. I do know that as part of DOT's planning process, they have been working very closely with some states to address, again, the formula funding problem to figure out what is the best way to work. And these are states across the board. These are, you know, these are states in the South as well as in the West and whatnot. So it's a good cohort of states that the DOT folks are working with. And I'm happy to forward their contact information for you.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just again want to thank you for your work and your excellent presentation this morning.
Thank you.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and thank you for the presentation. I always appreciate hearing perspectives on this issue. First, I got a question, but I got a couple things I just want to say first. First, I agree with some of the presentation, especially in terms of the disadvantaged areas and low-income areas. And I think we do need to look at to what degree they've been disparaged or disadvantaged, and to address that. Areas I have concern about or disagree, and I give you a little pushback, is, you know, there's plenty of literally thousands of scientists who disagree with the climate change, global warming agenda and how you want to solve it. And I can give you specifics and even a book by three qualified, eminently qualified scientists, why scientists disagree about global warming. And we need to continue to have that discussion. One was a petition, one area is a petition that was signed by over 31,000 U.S. scientists that more CO2 is beneficial, not detrimental to the environment. The third area, the real greenhouse gas that is damaging is methane, especially that comes from landfills. I had a landfill operator send me information from scientists about methane. It lasts, I think, 12 years longer than CO2 and does much more damage. And therefore, rather than creating huge piles of landfill, which is creating environmental problems and disasters going forward, we should be building incinerators and reducing the amount of methane that comes from landfills. So methane is the greenhouse gas that gives damage, not CO2, according to those scientists. The fourth thing, and then I have my question, you know, as far as electric cars or light rail is the biggest boondoggle we ever built in this state, or tried to build, still isn't done. Now they want to build more of them. But as far as batteries, I happen to have an individual I know in my district. His neighbor's son attends MIT, or he has, he's last year. And he was involved with battery research and making them more efficient. And the consistent problem that they have is the closer you put the plates in the battery, the greater the chance of an explosion that starts a fire. And the interesting thing, we had a longtime business, ever since I've been born, I remembered it, called Sam's Tire in Glencoe. They had battery tools plugged in overnight. They had a security camera. And one of those battery tools blew up. The battery blew up. It burnt the whole business to the ground just recently, okay? And they had it on film. And the interesting thing the adjuster said, because I know the business owners real well, is that because they're trying to create so much efficiency out of these batteries, almost any battery that you have plugged in for charging can blow up and start a fire. And it's extremely difficult to put out. You know, we had the Chevy Volt, and you can do your research. They were charging them at night. They were exploding and burning houses down. So the
Representative Boonhagen, would you mind getting to the question? We have one more colleague of yours who has a question and only a couple minutes left.
Yeah, this is it. As soon as I make this, then I ask the question. The Chevy Volt, General Motors said, well, don't park it in the garage and don't plug it in at night. So there's a lot of problems with this battery research. And the question is, wouldn't the testifiers agree with me that methane, not CO2, is the primary greenhouse gas that is causing problems in our environment?
So the question is on methane, and if the testifiers want to touch on the established science of climate change, you're welcome to as well. Ms. Martinez.
Sure. So there is a standardized way in which science does address the various greenhouse gas emissions, to your point. It's called global warming potential. So each one of the greenhouse gases has a residency in the atmosphere as well as a warming potential. What you're referring to is that methane does, in some ways, have a higher warming potential than carbon does. But carbon, by far, is the largest greenhouse gas across the globe. So it's very difficult to sort of assess and say which is more important, which is less important. It has to do with residency in the atmosphere. It has to do with warming potential, and it has to do with the total amount of emissions. That is why the total amount of emissions of carbon is much, much greater than methane. While methane does have a greater global warming potential, it is a lesser methane gas or greenhouse gas in terms of emissions. That all to say that none of the greenhouse gases are safe. I mean, obviously, they all contribute to climate change. And to your point, they do contribute to climate change. So the science has suggested that these is pretty solid in terms of climate change and the role of greenhouse gases in developing the problem of climate change. I think the administration, as well as many of the climate advocacy groups across the country, would argue that absolutely all greenhouse gases need to be addressed in a way that is safe and equitable to ensure that communities, including ecosystems, including communities at the international level, live safe, healthy, and vibrant lives, and that the impacts that climate change produces on many of these frontline communities will not be severe and threaten their livelihood.
Thank you, Ms. Martinez. Representative Igo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to Ms. Martinez and Mr. Kolosh for the presentation. Seriously, it was very in-depth, going into lots of different things. And I guess my observation of things, we're focusing a lot on what's happening here in Minnesota and here in the United States. You know, when it came to policy, comes to mandates, we're talking about how we're all interrelated. You know, Ms. Martinez, one of the things you said is, you know, we can't have any community left behind when we're talking about climate justice. And climate is intersectional with our air quality. So we're all in this together. And what kind of had my mind spurring here is that all this is kind of a supply and demand equation, right? And the policies and the mandates that we are talking about are going to increase our demand for the materials needed to do this, whether it be the batteries to build electric cars, right? Or it be to build new communities, you know, more green buildings for housing. But all of this, the problem that I have here is no one talked about the situation that we're building around the globe when we're developing these mechanisms here. So my question is you know, is this talked about at the federal level? And I would go to think it isn't, because President Biden just canceled a mine that would make the point I'm about to make very clear, is that as we talk about solar and wind and climate justice, climate equity, we might be doing it better here, but you're destroying the lives of thousands of people around the globe, right? There's a whole population of people in China who are being sterilized and forced to mine. There's whole populations of children who are mining with their hands in Africa, who are being enslaved as well with no labor standards, no environmental standards. It's happening in Indonesia as well. It's all coming across the ocean on gigantic ocean liners that are emitting more CO2 and toxic chemicals into our atmosphere than anything we do here. So my question to you is this being thought about when we're talking about climate justice here in Minnesota or the nation? Because it really should be part of the conversation, because in fact, all you're doing is pushing the problem somewhere else where it's not in our line of sight. And like you said, Ms. Martinez, in your testimony there, you know, we're all in this together and we can't leave a community behind, but these policies are leaving a lot of people behind.
Ms. Martinez, and then we're going to move to our next testifier.
Sure, thank you. What I can say is absolutely. As you know, there's a federal national climate advisor that was established by President Biden, in addition to an international climate office that is headed up by Secretary John Kerry. There are extensive conversations and discussions and planning between the two offices in order to address exactly the situation that you're talking about. Obviously, we are a nation that is one nation among many, and climate change is a global problem. What you see in terms of the president's agenda, in terms of the international arena, is trying to integrate how we can address the equity issues on an international level, knowing the way in which international agreements are made, and ensuring that we honor the sovereignty of nations, but in addition, try to be a leader at home in terms of these important issues. So I would say, yes, absolutely, these issues are being discussed on a daily basis in the administration. These are hard issues. These are hard questions. They have to do with international agreements, national sovereignty, et cetera. And I think, and they're not going to be solved tomorrow, just like the climate change problem is not going to be solved tomorrow. But they are being actively addressed by the federal government.
Thank you, Ms. Martinez. Thank you, Ms. Martinez and Mr. Kolash for being with us. We're going to move to our other testifiers, and then we'll have some time for questions at the end. If I could ask our testifiers to please try to do your best to keep the time, because we have quite a few folks we'd like to get through today. But next, we will be hearing from Kathleen Schuler with Health Professionals for a Healthy Climate. Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Schuler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to share my screen right now. Okay, can you see my screen?
We can. If you put it in presentation view, we'll be able to see the slide even better. Perfect.
Great, thank you. So my name is Kathleen Schuler. I'm Policy Director with Health Professionals for Healthy Climate. And I'm testifying today on the critical need to incorporate climate justice into all climate change policies. We need policies that move Minnesota to a carbon-free economy while addressing underlying racial and social inequalities. To provide clean, green jobs and support healthy and vibrant communities and protect public health. So we have submitted to the committee a document entitled Climate Justice and Public Health in Minnesota, Equitable Solutions to the Climate Crisis. And we have outlined a number of policy recommendations, some of which have already been passed by the Minnesota House. And these are endorsed by these health professional organizations, including HPHC, the Minnesota Public Health Association, Twin Cities Medical Society, Minnesota Doctors for Health Equity, Minnesota Psychological Association, and Minnesota Association of African American Physicians. So health professionals support climate justice. Now, other speakers have talked about climate impacts, but I'm going to focus on the health impacts of climate change. And in Minnesota, we are recognizing that there are underlying racial disparities in health. Compared to white Minnesotans, Minnesotans who are Black, Indigenous, or people of color experience higher incidence of many health conditions, including infant and maternal mortality, heart disease, cancer, asthma, diabetes, and other chronic illnesses. And communities of color experience shorter life expectancy. The average lifespan for a white Minnesotan is 81 years, and it's 74 for Black Minnesotans and 61 for people who are American Indians. Black and American Indian infants are twice as likely to die before their first birthday compared with white infants. And Mr. Kolesh talked about the impacts of climate change in Minnesota, but the fossil fuel pollution in general is responsible for an estimated 8.7 million premature deaths per year. And the fine particulate pollution, which is the most harmful, is linked to 350,000 premature deaths annually. And a higher proportion of these are affected by communities of color. So the changes that we're seeing in Minnesota, extreme heat, severe storms, flooding, wildfires, drought, vector-borne diseases, and air pollution are increasingly impacting the physical and mental health of Minnesotans. And we know that the underlying socioeconomic conditions, health disparities, and disproportionate exposure to pollution place BIPOC and low-income communities at highest risks from climate change with fewer resources to adapt to and recover from climate events. The Centers for Disease Control recognized the several factors that lead to social vulnerability to climate change and to extreme weather events. And these factors include living in poverty, living in an area of concentrated poverty or racially segregated housing, having underlying chronic health conditions or disabilities, language barriers, housing instability, being unemployed, and having lower levels of education. And we did talk about air pollution. And in Minnesota, we know that communities of color have higher exposure to air pollution because they live in high traffic areas and have more industrial pollutants in their neighborhoods. Exposure to air pollution is linked to numerous health problems, including hypertension, heart problems, asthma, stroke, chronic kidney disease, reduced birth weight, and premature death. And with climate change, we're seeing more extreme heat days, which result in more ground level ozone, which is linked to asthma exacerbations, adding increased health burden to communities already experiencing higher rates of asthma. Another thing that we're seeing with climate change is effects on the food system. Disruptions in food production and distribution mean reduced access and higher prices, impacting people who are already living in food deserts and have problems getting access to healthy food in the first place. Indigenous people have challenges, and we need to protect the wild and cultivated traditional foods that are critical to local economies and culture. And there are effects on farmers, and I know we're going to hear testimony about effects in agriculture, but the extreme rain events, drought, and adverse effects from warming temperatures affect the financial viability of the farming economy and the health and mental health of Minnesota farmers. Because communities of color live adjacent to many industrial toxic waste sites and industrial sites, there's a risk of chemical disasters. It places their health at risk from routine chemical exposures, as well as from extreme weather events that could release toxic substances into water, air, and soil, causing both acute and cumulative health impacts. And we've seen this with hurricanes such as Katrina, where there's chemical releases from flooding. And all of us have our mental health affected by climate change. Climate change just causes a lot of uncertainty and anxiety. Extreme weather events cause trauma, anxiety, and PTSD, and that's been documented from survivors of hurricanes. And majority communities of color are particularly susceptible to climate stressors because of existing trauma from violence, poverty, and racism. And finally, I just wanted to mention that the groups that are listed here have endorsed a climate change policy agenda, which we have submitted to you. Other speakers are going to go into detail about policies that are recommended, but on a high level, these are our recommendations: that we should prioritize policies that address underlying racial and social inequalities, create an inclusive carbon-free economy that provides clean, green jobs and resources for healthy communities, We need to work in partnership with EJ communities to create specific and long-term projects. And we need to support state, local, tribal, and community-level adaptation plans and investment in climate-resilient resources and infrastructures to protect EJ communities. I want to thank you for holding this hearing and for the opportunity to talk about health impacts. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Schuler, for that really informative presentation. Next, we're going to be hearing from Sarah Sanchez, who's the Community Impact Director from American Heart Association. Ms. Sanchez, welcome to the committee.
Great, thank you, Representative Wong. I am currently living in Frogtown community in St. Paul, and I'm gonna just share a little bit of my story as it relates to this conversation. So going back to June 2020, I was 24 weeks pregnant, and we were still in the beginning of understanding the implications of a pandemic, and just as significant, we're watching Minneapolis literally burn in real over the murder of George Floyd and the resulting unrest. And I think most pregnant people will share the discomfort of the heat that pregnancy can bring. And we were renting a multifamily housing space. We had one wall unit that we kept in the bedroom to at least keep it somewhat cooler for me as I was getting more uncomfortable. And then we were doing daily walks outside as a way to get fresh air. But that was another battle with the heat. We were going through some hot days leading up to that. 2 days before I made it to 24 weeks, the heat was really getting to me, and I couldn't make it through that usual walk. Sat down a few times, felt contractions. I'd never made it this far in pregnancy, so I wasn't sure that it was, you know, if it was practice contractions or called Braxton Hicks, or if something else was going on. I had a meeting or an appointment scheduled with my OB that Monday, but it was virtual because of COVID restrictions. So we chatted. She wasn't too concerned, but I insisted that she see me. I just had a feeling that something wasn't right. She visited with me, and as the exam started, took 1 minute, and she said, "I'm so sorry, you are in labor." This is 24 weeks, really down to the exact day where viability is considered for what they'll treat often in hospital. So that was in my mind. I rushed to Mother Baby Center at Abbott Northwestern with armed guards from the National Guard with us to make sure that we could get there safely because of what was going on in the city. They did their best to stop labor. The goal was for me to be on bed rest as long as I could, which would have been 16 weeks to full terms, and I made it 3 days. So my daughter, Edith Gray, was born 1 pound, 9 ounces. We spent 111 days there in the NICU with her after given a 50% chance of survival. She beat pneumonia twice. She had multiple blood transfusions, surgery, stopped breathing once in front of me where she was bagged and intubated just in time to save her life. And me holding her meant that multiple people had to transfer her over to make sure her breathing tube and ventilator parts stayed in place. Thankfully, we're doing okay today. She was sent home on oxygen and had breathing support for a while. But the point of this, our story continues here, but there's something larger at play, and it's what we're talking about. Rachel Hardiman, a professor at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health, has been working with an epidemiology researcher, Luke Smith, to really understand this connection between global warming and racial disparities. And she found that Black women are at a higher risk for preterm births during heat waves than white women. And the most troubling finding in this was that college-educated Black women appeared more susceptible after heat wave exposure, with a 1.27 time more likely to experience premature labor than white women without a college education. As a college educated biracial woman, I am that statistic. I recognize and acknowledge at the same time the privilege that gave me and my daughter a chance. I was heard by my medical team. I had the insurance access and flexibility to be able to go into the office and be seen by my OB. And that one cool room in my home was more than some have, but it was important. And I won't discount the impact that what was happening around us as a community in crisis and what that meant to me as a Black woman in this story. And that's why I continue to share this. That's why I'm sharing this with you now, no matter how hard it is. I owe it to those who don't have that similar positive outcome or a way to manage the heat and the changes that we're seeing in climate. And researchers say that exposure to heat is an unhealthy stressor, but that's, you know, compounding on where people work, where people live, what they have access to around them to manage that. And the impacts of climate change and rising temperatures are being uncovered in spaces that we haven't imagined like this. And not talking only about premature death, but premature birth and the impacts of that as well. So we have to continue pushing this messaging and prioritizing infrastructure around climate justice. And I thank you for your time and for allowing me to share.
Thank you so much, Ms. Sanchez, for being willing to share your powerful story. And I know it can't be easy to remember those hard times, but I think it's important that we hear your message. And we know that as Minnesota is warming, a lot of our residents don't have access to air conditioning, are experiencing these heat stresses, and that doesn't fall equally in all Minnesotans. So I'm just thankful that you're here today and thankful that Edith Gray is doing well. Next, we're going to hear from Martin Larson, who's an Olmsted County farmer with LSP Soil Health and Climate Steering Committee. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Larson.
Hi, thanks. Can everyone hear me? And I'm going to share my screen. So I am a farmer in Olmsted County, Minnesota, just west of Rochester. I've farmed my whole life. We've had livestock, grew up with pigs, had a dairy, a small dairy as well. But that went away as it was more difficult to have small scale livestock on our farm. I'm a land stewardship farmer member and on their climate steering committee. And I thank you for having me here. This is my farm. This is where I live. It was brought into the family in 1857 in land settlement days. So, no other family, has owned that other than the Native Americans. So it's very important to me to be able to pass this down in a generational sense. This is my father, my uncle, me, and my son. My son would be generation six if he chooses to farm. And I farm 700 acres. It's all no-till. I cover crop most of it. I have small grains now on a third of the acres. And I also log and manage 150 acres of forest lands, have a sawmill. So we're fairly diversified. I work for the Olmsted County SWCD. I work with other farmers. It gives me the opportunity to know a lot of farmers in the region, trade ideas, hear concerns. And I'm also president of the Minnesota Caving Club. My background, which I didn't intend, but that's inside of a cave in Minnesota. So this gives me this unique perspective of weather, climate, farming, agriculture, lands in Minnesota. That I can see it from above and farm on it, but see it below inside the cave. And most people don't know, but there is climate history, thousands, hundreds of thousands of years of climate history recorded inside the caves of Minnesota. So there's been science done on that. I want to share my experiences since 2013, and I liken it to like having one hand in a freezer and the other hand in an oven. On average, I'm comfortable, but these extremes that I've experienced on the farm have been costly, have been stressful, have hurt my productivity on the farm. I like to take photos. Here's two storms in 2019 that caused this. The top photo made national news, that region. He's a friend of mine. Bob Eustace, he went to school with my parents. I went to school with his kids. And that's where the livestock were being swept away down the Zumbro River, and that made national news. It's hard on our infrastructure, on our ditches, our ditch clean out, the cost that it takes to clean ditches, these floods. You can see our county roads had significant damage. And at my house, I received 54 inches of rain that year. which isn't just a little bit over normal. It's twice what we would normally have of 30 inches. Other experiences, friends of mine had their barns collapsed in spring of 2019. They were milking 300 in that barn. The stress that caused them was substantial. I've seen polluted wells due to flooding, gullies and erosion that remind me of the Dust Bowl pictures and the erosion that happened before conservation was implemented. And of course, it's all in the news. As early as a month and a half ago in December in a historic tornado outbreak. So we've seen it from flooding to drought to heat, and each one plays a role. This is as recent of December, and then this summer at my place, I had a small spin-up tornado. That's where my fertilizer comes from before it's applied to my field there at Grand Meadow, Minnesota. And this is a friend of mine up on top where I went to help him clean up after the December 15th storm. And what Kathleen said about mental health, I've witnessed that firsthand with myself and damage on my farm. But my friends we have to drive into our yards and see this. And this is an extension of us. You know, farmers are connected with the weather in a special way. So what have I done then to become more resilient? And one thing is to become diversified and plant other things other than corn and soybeans. So one is oats or small grains. This is my dog, and we're out checking the oat field 2 years ago. The advantage about oats is they're a low water use crop. They're done by August. We harvest them. That crop is done. We can check that off the list. I can. The problem with oats is they're not subsidized like corn and soybeans in our farm programs. And there are some market challenges that could be addressed with initiatives to enhance small grains production in Minnesota. Here's my place again, and I'm really proud to grow oats for food. One thought I've had is, where is this corn going to go? I grow a lot of corn. I love growing corn. I love combining it. When electric cars fill in behind gasoline, it's going to happen because Ford, Chevy, they're investing billions of dollars in it. Our corn goes to ethanol. Every kernel I grow goes through an ethanol plant. So it's important to me to find an alternative crop that I can plant. And I've been learning and establishing oats. I established cover crops to keep my farm from washing away. That's my son and my custom built interseeding, so I can seed cover crops between the growing corn rows. I plant green. I keep things as green as possible, and to keep it also for keep it from washing away. That's for me, for the community, and for the environment. It's capturing carbon. Here's what it looks like when I harvest green. So I'd like to, thank you again for your time. And these are my experiences. And I think that there's opportunities for farmers to lead the charge in the climate resilience.
Thank you so much, Mr. Larson, for being with us and for sharing the story. Next, we are hearing from Anjali Baines, who is the Director of Energy Access and Equity with Fresh Energy. Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Baines.
Thank you for having me. Can you see my screen and hear me?
I can. If you can put your slides in presentation mode, then be able to see it even better. Perfect.
Wonderful. Good morning, all, and thank you for having me. My name is Anjali Baines, and I lead the Energy Access and Equity team at Fresh Energy, a St. Paul-based clean energy advocacy nonprofit. I'll be talking a little bit today about energy affordability and how addressing that can both reduce energy burden on households while also addressing climate change. And I'll move a little quickly to try to save us some time for questions at the end of all the presentations. So before we get into solutions, I want to quickly provide some context on why this issue is so important right now. All of us here, and as we've been hearing, know that the weather is getting more extreme, particularly in the summer where heat waves are happening earlier and for longer. Pair that with rising energy costs and rising housing costs, and it means that more Minnesotans are paying even more of the income to try to maintain a safe indoor environment than before, if they're even able to do so. It's important to note that renters and owners of older homes without proper insulation or cooling systems are at a significant disadvantage to respond to extreme weather, since they don't often have the funds or approval to make these upgrades. Add on top of all that, the fact that burning fuels lead to significant levels of indoor air pollution that harm our health, and it's clear that more needs to be done in this area. The good news is that energy efficiency can help to address each of these issues while also reducing climate change causing emissions and improving communities' health and resiliency along the way. And it's not just a metro area. Energy costs is an issue that impacts all Minnesotans, with many of the most energy burdened households residing in Greater Minnesota. Energy burden is defined as the percent of household income spent on energy, with under-resourced households experiencing energy burdens four times higher than the state average of 2%, and some residents in Greater Minnesota spending as much as 30% of their income on energy bills in a given month. The good news is there are many things we can do to reduce energy burden through policymaking. The first is investing in more and deeper energy efficiency programs. While utilities run many energy efficiency programs, the state has a clear role in administering the federally funded Weatherization Assistance Program, which provides vital home repairs and upgrades for the most under-resourced households. However, because this program is income qualified, there are still more homes who do not qualify for assistance but could still use support to make their homes more efficient and healthier and save on their energy bills. The state can step in here to fund weatherization above and beyond what the Weatherization Assistance Program does to make sure that more Minnesotans have healthier, safer homes that help them save money on it, not lose it. Investing in pre-weatherization is another solution. Pre-weatherization are actions required before a home can be weatherized and include things like asbestos removals and replacing old wiring. Pre-weatherization is unfortunately not allowed to be used under federal funding, so it is a prime opportunity for the state to step in and fund as well. Other solutions include supporting the move to use electricity to power homes. Electricity is not only more efficient, but prices are more stable than fuels like natural gas and can greatly improve indoor air quality. Just like with weatherization, though, homes do need to be prepped to be electrified, often by upgrading their electric panels. This is particularly true of older homes and is another opportunity for investment from the state to ensure that all homes have the opportunity to electrify, not just the wealthiest. Finally, direct assistance programs and making sure new homes are built more efficiently and are electric are also necessary parts of the solutions and can be addressed through increasing funding for a direct assistance program or improving our building codes and energy performance standards. Finally, and this came up earlier, apologies for that. Finally, it's really important that these policies are designed with the people who most need them in mind. In this case, making sure that these programs are actually reaching renters, multifamily and affordable housing residents, often who have populations that are most under-resourced and are people of color within them. So by making sure that these programs do actually benefit these communities, you can also make sure the program ends up supporting all Minnesotans who need them. Finally, energy burden is just one piece of the climate justice puzzle. There's a lot of other things, as we've heard today, that the state can step in and fund. Increasing access and affordability of electric transportation is one of those. Diversifying and developing a clean energy workforce is another big area. As we talk about funding more of these energy efficiency programs, there's also a need to make sure there's enough program implementers out there to actually do the energy efficiency upgrades, and that's a really critical part for the state to help in and figure out how to do that workforce development. And finally, making sure that decision-making that policymakers are doing is inclusive and listening to and changing as a result of community impact, which I think we'll hear a little bit more in other presenters. All right, that is it. Thank you, everyone, for taking the time. Happy to take questions over email after the fact, but I will stop there.
Thank you so much, Ms. Bates. I'm going to turn it over now to Representative Lee, who I've asked to touch a little bit on a bill of his that was in the environment omnibus last session, but is directly relevant to the topic that we are talking about today. And then he will introduce a number of individuals who he's worked with on that cumulative impacts bill. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members, for the opportunity to talk about Bill Draft B-130, which should be introduced today when we head into session. This is just an updated draft of House File 168, which was included in the Environment Finance Bill last year. Mr. Chair, you know, I don't want to repeat what most of the testifiers have said. We know and understand that, you know, the burden of air pollution is not evenly shared. According to the American Lung Association, poor people and some racial and ethnic groups are among those who often face higher exposure to pollutants and who may have experienced greater responses to such pollution, as shared by Kathleen and some of the folks here. And so just quickly about the updated bill draft, we just added some more definition of what does environmental justice mean. Environmental justice means that communities of color, indigenous communities, and low-income communities have a healthy environment and are treated fairly when environmental statutes, rules, and policies are developed, adopted, implemented, and enforced. And in all decisions that have the potential to affect the environment of environmental justice area or the public health of its residents, due consideration is given to the history of the areas and its residents' cumulative exposure to pollutants and to any current social economic conditions that increase the physical sensitivity of those residents to additional exposure to pollutants. And Mr. Chair, I've been working on this bill ever since I entered the legislature back in 2017. And with me today are three, strong advocates from the community members. The first one, I'll just quickly introduce them and you can go through and calling them for their public testimony. Marco Hernandez, who is the public policy director from Kapaa, Minnesota. And then two of my constituents, Roxanne O'Brien, who is a community member, who's with Community Member Environmental Justice. And she's an activist. And then Tasia Cleveland, a young environmental justice activist, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Representative Lee. We'll start with Mr. Hernandez. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And also a huge thanks to Representative Lee for all the work that he has done for us too, especially on the cumulative impacts legislation. And so I'm gonna do this quickly, so make sure that Roxanne has the full 10 minutes. So I come from one of the biggest frontline communities in the country, located in Richmond, California. It is one of the most diverse areas in the Bay Area, but it's also home to the second biggest refinery in the state of California, the Chevron refinery. Richmond is not unique when it comes to communities of color being home to huge polluters. Unfortunately, we see frontline communities throughout this country, and there are many in the state in which are also homes to polluters themselves. For example, the trash incinerators located in Mankato, Rochester, Minneapolis, and Red Wing are located within frontline communities and affect them negatively. COPAL, as an organization, saw it was important to team up with Roxanne and community members for environmental justice to push the cumulative impacts bill with Representative Fu Lee. And so a coalition of 15 plus organizations and individuals came out of this partnership to fight for stronger environmental protections for frontline and BIPOC communities. Not only does our coalition continue to grow its membership, COPAL has done a survey of the Latino community throughout the state that validates our push for cumulative impacts. 52% of our survey respondents are worried about the air pollution coming from businesses, factories, and incinerators nearby them, and 67% would like more access to healthier and affordable communities. When it comes to healthy communities with high qualities of living, they are really expensive and inaccessible to poor BIPOC individuals and families. And sometimes when we do the push for making communities healthier, we do see an unfortunate result, which is green gentrification. In addition, formerly redlined areas have an average of around 23% tree canopy coverage, compared with approximately 43% tree canopy cover in areas previously restricted to all white populations. Basically, there are less trees in frontline communities, and all these factors create urban heat islands, concentrated pollution, poor air quality that lowers life expectancies in these communities, and increased health disparities. And once you start adding polluting facilities into the mix, it is not good for folks living in frontline and BIPOC communities. And so I agree with Representative Fu Lee and CMEJ that we see the need to pass a cumulative impacts bill, and we see it as the beginning of equitable changes in the state of Minnesota. And so thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and I'm very excited to hear from our colleague, Roxanne.
Thank you so much, Mr. Hernandez. Next, we'll hear from Ms. O'Brien, and I'll just note that we were fortunate to have you host, along with Representative Lee, an environmental justice tour recently that a number of our, I think, committee members were able to go on. And so thank you for your hospitality and taking us around your community. Ms. O'Brien, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate that you guys come and visit us in our community. Sometimes it makes it a little easier to have human conversation and contact with people. But thank you. I also just want to pass this on to Tasia first. She's a younger person, and I want to give her the floor first, and then I'll end it out.
Sounds good. Ms. Cleveland, welcome to the committee.
Okay, I forgot to push you. Hi, guys. I'm Tasia. I'm a part of CMEJ. I'm 20 years old, and I'm a mom.
I gotta set my phone down. Okay. Climate change. So I'm going to talk about climate change. Climate change is already affecting families here. Areas with historic disinvestment of infrastructure and a pollution-driven health burden have a harder time adapting to increased heat days, flooding, and extreme weather situations. We saw that back when the tornado hit in this area like 10 years ago in 2011, and its impacts on housing, and seeing it today on community health with the extreme heat temperatures over the long summers. The work that our communities do for environmental justice is critical, but can only do so much, as we need like stronger public policy. We are not only on the front lines of climate change, but industries here contribute to a significant amount to generating that climate burden for us in the whole state. And this is why basically everything that I said and what they have said is like why we need this cumulative bill to be passed. It's very important. Oh yeah, and I forgot to say thank you, Fu Lee, and thank you for the Climate Committee for having us today, for having CMEJ today. Yeah.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Ms. O'Brien.
Thank you. I'd also like to say thank you to the Climate Committee and to Fu, and to all the people that are working on passing this cumulative impact bill. I would like to also remind people that Community Members for Environmental Justice was the first coalition to work on this bill with Fu. And as environmental justice resources come in from the government, I hope that people remember those of us who have been constantly and consistently on the front lines. I also want to thank COPAL for joining us in this work and giving us the time, extra time today. So, what is environmental justice? To understand environmental justice, you have to acknowledge environmental racism and environmental classism. Once you acknowledge and admit these historic harmful practices that continue to happen in Black and brown and poor white communities like mine, then you get to decide if you will address these problems with policies and solutions, or will you continue historic racist policies and inaction. That's where environmental justice comes in. Environmental justice is a grassroots solution to undoing these isms and harmful policies that government have allowed and permitted to build and define our societies and environments. Right now, the cumulative impact of particulate matter pollution, social stressors like inadequate housing and racism are layering on top of each other, suffocating our neighborhoods. But this cumulative impacts bill is a solution start to undoing some of the environmental injustices occurring in our overburdened communities. This bill would require cumulative impacts analysis for permitted projects. The MPCA would not be allowed to just issue permits to facilities in metropolitan counties without first analyzing and considering the cumulative levels and effects of past and current environmental pollution. Right now, like Tasia and I and other people from our coalition, we have been patient and consistently showing up for the past, I think, more than 3 years, hoping to awaken people's humanity and people's accountability. And although we haven't passed this bill yet, I have confidence that we will. There's a quote that I want to end with that says, "The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The next best time is today." This bill is like a tree that should have been planted hundreds of years ago. But we still have a chance to plant that seed today. So again, for the third year, we thank you for this time. And we look forward to celebrating with you when this bill is passed in the near future. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. O'Brien. And thank you, Representative Lee, for your leadership on the cumulative impacts, which I know was something that our first speaker, Ms. Martinez, touched on as well as an important issue for the federal government as well. Representative Lee, anything you'd like to close with?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for hearing from the community members that I've been working with on this critical issue. And we know that to Roxanne's point that in the past, there have been intentional siting of these facilities, within our frontline communities who are, predominantly, Black, Indigenous, communities of color, and, what Roxanne said, our lower income, white communities. And so we really need to look at this and see what can we do at the state level to address this injustice for all of our community members so that we as a state can, actually move forward and, provide for the clean air that, all of our residents believe that we have. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for this opportunity.
Thank you so much, Representative Lee. All right, we're going to go to member questions first, and I'll begin with members who have not asked questions today, and then we'll go to other members. Representative Hollins.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Lee, also for bringing this really important legislation. I am obviously very passionate about this. Like, these would impact a lot of my district, where there are low income and communities of color who have been directly impacted by, a lot of the work that's been happening in the city of St. Paul. And I am really interested to know, we know systemically that there are, there's always ways of getting around the rules that we make with the best of intentions, because systems exist and it's difficult to stop them. So I guess my question here is, how do you see this bill, the enactment of this bill, impacting future decisions that are made for these communities? And in particular, do you see this as being able to be reworked or a good strong basis for what's going to happen in the future as people try to find ways to work around it? Because I think anytime there's less pressure, less engagement, less money, right? Like, people find ways to harm those communities earliest. And so I'm interested to know, do you see this as being a long-term solution? And how do you see this being built upon for the future?
We'll start with Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hollins, for that question. I think that this bill is the first step in us really bringing to the table the voices of our communities, where we're requiring the NPCA to analyze and consider the cumulative levels of and effects of past and current environmental pollution before issuing, renewing, or approving a major amendment to an air permit. And we also are requiring, you know, like the public hearing so that, you know, public community members like those that are here today can actually have a say. And if, you know, a community actually wants something or a facility that may be, considered under one of these permits, that they can actually say that too. And so we're allowing for the public to be able to voice their opinion. I think that that's the first step. And, you know, having some transparency with what's going on with some of these permits that, you know, potentially may be impacting the health and the wellness of Minnesotans.
Thank you. Representative Swasinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, I had a question for the woman or the presenter from, maybe it was Fresh Energy. I forget it.
Ms. Baines.
Yes, I think that might be it. Just my question was, you know, the top three things that you talked about were, you know, investments into homes and the rest and how the state needs to pay for that. Just kind of wondering, like, how does that combo, you know, we have Minneapolis and I believe St. Paul have each implemented rent controls. So the ability to, if you invest in your property to make it better as a homeowner or and then to rent it out, you're limited on how much you could actually recapture of that. How will those types of controls cause disinvestment in homes and apartments because you can't actually capture the cost of those improvements? Do you feel that that could potentially impact this?
Ms. Baines.
Sure. Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Representative. So I have to clarify that, you know, Fresh Energy is a clean energy organization. We don't know the nuances of housing policy. That being said, especially when it comes to rent control, St. Paul passed rent control with a 3% increase every year. Minneapolis is considering passing rent control. It's up to the city council right now. Having investments and funding from the state actually supports these homes and homeowners investing in upgrades because it means they don't have to put the capital outlay to make the improvements and then actually supports more rent stabilization because they can, you know, increase rents a certain percent, make back what they've put in, but don't have to pay for all the upgrades because the funding's from the state. So actually, in this case, I would say rent stabilization and investments from the state on improving homes goes hand in hand really well, and then you can keep more folks in healthier, safer homes as well.
Representative Swasinski, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm just kind of clarifying. So my understanding is that if, because of these rent controls, if the state doesn't step up and spend more money, you will see a disinvestment. You will see people getting out of rental, and therefore you'll see less housing available because of them, which I think is a disappointment. Is there a rough estimate on the cost? Like if you were to take a direct cost, you know, this is a racial justice environment bill that we're discussing. Like what will be the cost of energy once this problem is solved? Like what do you estimate? Like if we were to pass all the initiatives, you know, pay for all this stuff, what will that cost in real terms, families in Minnesota without government subsidy?
Was that question directed to Ms. Baines again?
No, it could be just to anyone, maybe the bill author or just anyone that would like to talk about it.
Okay, well, it's a pretty broad question. I'll put it back to Ms. Baines because I think you might have mischaracterized what she said in her original response. Ms. Baines.
Thank you, Representative. Yes, I would like to clarify that I don't believe, this is more speaking as a probably personal citizen, I don't believe the rent stabilization policies will lead to disinvestment, nor do I think that the state is the only means for energy efficiency investment. As we're in a hearing about state investments, the focus has been on state investments, but there's other alternatives in the private market to do energy efficiency upgrades, to do better homes. There are developers in the Twin Cities who are doing their best to build healthier, more affordable, efficient housing in the Twin Cities. So a lot of options to deal with, both needing to do upgrades while also keeping rents at a reasonable level for the folks who are living in those homes. The point about overall energy costs, that's a great question. I think that's a very big question and hard to have a pithy answer, but I'll talk to the folks internally at Fresh Energy and see if we can get a response to that.
Thank you, Ms. Baines. Representative Igo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question is pretty quick, and it's also actually for Ms. Baines. So we were talking about how we need to electrify everything and move towards having more, you know, whether that be solar and wind powering all of that. My question for you today, and today's a great day because it was negative 33 degrees in my district this morning. It was freezing cold. So I did what I usually do, which is look up the MISO energy grid. And today we are keeping our homes warm with 47% coal, 23% natural gas, and almost 15% nuclear, and the rest is wind and solar. So that's about 12.5%. So my question to you is, you know, we're talking about making sure we have equity and everyone's paying the same energy prices, but if we're gonna mandate policy and create policy that's gonna create this electrification of our of heating and keeping our homes full of energy, whether it be lights or whatever, we're gonna see costs go through the roof because we're mandating all of this. And my question to you is, isn't that just defeating the purpose of your organization? Because that's not creating equity, it's just gonna make, you know, more or less income people suffer even more with rising energy costs because of mandates. That's how the free market works. And that would affect my communities in northern Minnesota, not just affect them because they won't be able to pay, they would freeze, frankly. So that's my question usually. How do we fix that? Because that's not mandates and policy. That's, you know, you're messing with the free market and that never works.
Ms. Baines, on the cost of clean energy.
Sure. So I just to clarify, Representative, are you referring to specifically having renewable energy goals or decarbonized goals in our clean electricity or mandating electrification in our homes? Just want to clarify.
Representative Igo.
Frankly, my question is just with mandates and goals. Goals are one thing. Those are driven by the consumer, and that is great. But mandates on communities and on energy co-ops, that is not the right thing to do because, like I said, all it does is increase the demand for the materials needed to electrify. And I can go back to my further point, my further question. We don't have a source to do that here, so you're just destroying the world while you do it and causing more damage everywhere else. So, my question is, what are we doing that's actually going to help with equity here? Because in my summary of this, in my understanding, we're actually just creating a larger gap between everybody and causing more strife.
Ms. Baines.
Sure. Thank you for the clarification, Representative. So on the clean energy side, actually, renewable energy is among the most cost-effective forms of energy out there. So by increasing the amount of clean electricity on our grid, we're actually contributing to lower overall energy costs. And sometimes goals work, but sometimes utilities and other decision makers need a push because there hasn't been progress. There's been goals in the past, they haven't been met. And that's where some of the requirements on utilities come around. That being said, a group like Fresh Energy and generally policymaking in general is not just mandates. And we do a combination wanting to support market-based solutions as well as performing goals or just increasing funds for these opportunities. So on the home electrification front, for instance, there are no mandates. No one would be being put into a situation where they'd be unsafe in their homes. But by at least offering funds up, we can then provide more of incentive for the market to respond, for homeowners to have a choice to electrify and have more efficient homes. So it's a combination of policies. And I'll just also mention on the point about sourcing minerals elsewhere for the clean energy transition. That's a topic that is very important that you know, I want to be able to point to a resource. I actually wrote a blog post back in the summer, Fresh Energy on Electric Vehicles and the Batteries, and some of the good work that's happening around making sure that mining these batteries is done responsibly. So I'm happy to send that resource over to folks in this committee if they're interested as well.
Thank you, Ms. Baines. Representative Hornstein.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Lee, for this bill. I strongly support it. Appreciate your work on it. You know, one of the original environmental justice issues had to do with lead and lead exposure, particularly with kids in EJ-impacted neighborhoods. And so I don't know who the appropriate person would be to ask this, but maybe Ms. O'Brien. What are some of the – I know lead is a source toxin from the garbage incinerator downtown. What are some of the other – what other work is being done on lead? You know, we had the lead pipes issue in Flint, Michigan. Is there some – are there other sources and strategies to address the lead question?
Ms. O'Brien.
I mean, I think as a person in the community who has been doing a lot of work with a coalition to hold accountable some of these bad actors or facilities, we came up with a lot of ideas on how different jurisdictions and different departments can work together in holding these facilities accountable. I think policies are one way at the state level, but also are important at the city level. We found that a lot of people had different responsibilities from different jurisdictions. The fire department, for example, there's a lot of, it wasn't just lead, but yeah, there was mercury, there's chromium, there was all sorts of things coming out of this facility. And it doesn't just go in the air. I mean, it goes in the soil and then it goes into the water. So you have to address these things holistically. And so I think as people like yourselves start to actually do something, you know, instead of, you know, sometimes we just research and we know the facts already and we know that these things are harmful to elders and children, but we have to change policies and these are the ways to do that. I think I've heard some concerns about the free market, but I'm not hearing any concerns about human beings. And I think that's just as concerning. This free market it's not free, you know, like this earth is not free and we don't have an infinite amount of resources. So we're going to have to do better at taking care of the things that most matter. You can't eat money. You can't drink money. You can't, you know, these corporations aren't going to save us. This earth is going to save us. I mean, if we actually treat it accordingly, I think if we treat it as if we appreciate it and are grateful for these resources, then it will return the favor. I think the question is, yeah, I'm sorry.
No, we're a little over time.
Okay, no problem.
Thank you so much for your response. Thank you, members, and thank you to all our wonderful presenters today for an excellent hearing. Our next meeting.
I've had my hand held for quite a long time.
I'm sorry, Representative Franzen, we're out of time for the day. We're over time. Our next meeting is Tuesday, February 8th at 10:30. We'll be hearing from the Department of Commerce on the Federal Infrastructure and Energy Bill, as well as from the Department of Administration on Representatives BiClean study that just was released, which responds to a number of the concerns that have been raised earlier today about incentivizing clean production here in the U.S. And with that, our committee is adjourned.